Welcome to NEJM This Week. I'm Dr. Lisa Johnson. This week, we present research on high-risk coronary intervention strategies, targeted therapy for pancreatic cancer, an mRNA influenza vaccine, and treatments for severe scabies and sickle cell disease. We review cerebral amyloid angiopathy and follow a complex case of a disseminated infection. Perspectives address the impact of corporate medicine on medical training and drug pricing policy. A new clinical decisions on teaching anatomy asks whether to dissect or not to dissect. You are the dean of education in a medical school and are considering a redesign of the anatomy curriculum in the school. You know that anatomy is a fundamental component of medical school education, yet the preferred method for teaching it remains a topic of debate. In this feature, we present two essays, one recommending continuing the practice of anatomical dissection, and the other supporting replacing anatomical dissection with technological learning tools. Which would you choose? Read the vignette and essays at nejm.org and make your decision. Left ventricular unloading in high-risk percutaneous coronary intervention by Devaka Pereira from King's College London and co-authors. Percutaneous coronary intervention, PCI, is a cornerstone of treating patients with acute coronary syndromes or limiting symptoms that are caused by obstructive coronary disease and ischemia. However, the procedure can be associated with a high risk of major complications in patients with impaired left systolic function or death, especially when the coronary disease is extensive and complex. Would percutaneous left ventricular unloading through the use of mechanical circulatory support in such patients improve outcomes? In this study, 300 patients with severe left ventricular dysfunction and extensive coronary artery disease were randomly assigned to a strategy of elective unloading with a microaxial flow pump or to standard care during planned complex PCI. Among these patients, elective left ventricular unloading with a microaxial flow pump did not reduce the risk of major adverse clinical outcomes at 12 months or longer. Brahmaji Nalamatu and Brett Wanamaker from the University of Michigan, Ann Arbor, write in an editorial that, as a community, we have accepted an expanding use of mechanical circulatory support in high-risk PCI without consistent evidence that this approach improves survival or quality of life. Yet there are tangible consequences of that choice. Large bore access site injuries, bleeding, limb ischemia, hemolysis, and acute kidney injury in patients already near the limits of physiological reserve. We tolerate these complications because of a presumption of benefit. Thus, the findings by Pereira and co-authors force the interventional cardiologist to occupy an uncomfortable position between two unsatisfying options: the potential burden of perceived undertreatment when a patient's condition deteriorates, or recognition that the act of doing more may itself constitute harm. Any honest appraisal must begin with that tension. Pereira and co-authors provide sufficient data to encourage a more selective approach to the use of mechanical circulatory support in high-risk PCI, particularly in the absence of clear hemodynamic instability. The results of the forthcoming PROTECT-4 trial, which will enroll more than 1,200 patients, may finally provide the scale of evidence that the field requires. Until those data are available, the trial by Pereira reminds us that the price of protection is not borne by those who prescribe it, but by the patients who receive it. Whether the protection being offered is theirs or ours remains the central question yet to be answered. Diroximrasib in previously treated advanced RAS-mutated pancreatic cancer by Brian Wolpin from the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, Boston, and co-authors. Pancreatic ductal adenocarcinoma is a highly lethal cancer, and most patients present with advanced disease at the time of diagnosis. Current therapies for patients with pancreatic ductal adenocarcinoma provide modest benefit. Activating RAS mutations occur in more than 90% of these solid tumors. Diroximrasib is an oral RAS(ON) multi-selective inhibitor with activity against the active state of mutant and wild-type RAS. Diroximrasib forms a tri-complex inside cells that blocks RAS from activating its downstream signals. In this Phase 1-2 study, 168 patients with advanced solid tumors with activating RAS mutations who had received at least one previous line of chemotherapy received 10 to 400 milligrams of diroximrasib orally once daily. Among these patients, diroximrasib showed anti-tumor activity and was associated with treatment-related adverse events of grade 3 or higher in one-third of patients. In a Science Behind the Study editorial, Channing Durr and Zhenzhen Ye from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill write that in the context of second-line treatment, Wolpin and co-authors reported an objective response to diroximrasib in up to 35% of patients and a median response duration of 8.2 months. However, resistance can and does occur. Wolpin and co-authors report that treatment was discontinued in most patients for disease progression, which highlights the need to understand the primary and adaptive mechanisms of resistance. Other strategies are being evaluated. Identifying predictive biomarkers of response and rationally designing combination strategies to overcome resistance mechanisms to diroximrasib will be essential to improving on the unprecedented responses to this single-agent small molecule inhibitor in pancreatic ductal adenocarcinoma. Efficacy and safety of an mRNA seasonal influenza vaccine in adults by Isabelle Leroux-Rules from the Ghent University, Belgium, and co-authors. Seasonal influenza causes substantial illness and death in adults 50 years of age or older, even with current vaccines. An investigational messenger RNA-based vaccine under development called mRNA-1010 encodes hemagglutinin glycoproteins from influenza strains recommended by the World Health Organization. In this Phase 3 trial, more than 40,000 adults 50 years of age or older were randomly assigned to receive trivalent mRNA-1010 or a licensed standard dose comparator vaccine. The median follow-up was 181 days. Influenza-like illness, confirmed with RT-PCR assay, was observed in 2% of recipients of mRNA-1010 and in 2.8% of recipients of the standard dose comparator, which corresponded to a relative vaccine efficacy of 26.6%, thereby meeting the criteria for non-inferiority, superiority, and higher-level superiority. Solicited adverse reactions, including injection site pain, fatigue, headache, and myalgia, were more frequent with mRNA-1010. Combined oral ivermectin and 5% permethrin cream to treat severe scabies by Charlotte Bernigaud from the Hôpital Henri Mondor, Créteil, France, and co-authors. Severe scabies, a rare parasitic skin disease characterized by abundant skin mites, may be life-threatening and poses public health concerns worldwide. A combination of standard dose oral ivermectin and topical scabicides is recommended for treatment. However, data from randomized clinical trials are lacking, and the probability of cure is uncertain. Ivermectin at higher doses has been effective in the treatment of some parasitic diseases. In this trial, adults with severe scabies, that is, profuse or crusted, were randomly assigned to receive oral ivermectin at a dose of 400 micrograms per kilogram of body weight, higher dose group, or 200 micrograms per kilogram, standard dose group, on days 0, 7, and 14, combined with head-to-toe application of 5% permethrin cream on days 0 and 7, and daily application, as recommended, of an emollient cream. Cure was observed in 75% of the patients in the higher dose group and in 82% of those in the standard dose group. Among adults, a higher dose of ivermectin plus 5% permethrin cream was not superior to the standard dose of ivermectin plus 5% permethrin cream in curing severe scabies. Base editing of HBG1 and HBG2 promoters for sickle cell disease by Ashish Gupta from the University of Minnesota, Minneapolis, and co-authors. Sickle cell disease is characterized by chronic hemolytic anemia and recurrent severe vaso-occlusive crises. Ristoglogene autogatemcel, Ristocel, includes autologous CD34 hematopoietic stem and progenitor cells that have been base edited to target the HBG1 and HBG2 promoters and inhibit BCL11A binding without altering BCL11A expression, yielding a switch in hemoglobin production from sickle hemoglobin to anti-sickling fetal hemoglobin. This phase 1-2 study enrolled 31 patients 12 to 35 years of age with sickle cell disease who had had at least 4 severe vaso-occlusive crises in the 2 years before enrollment. After myeloablative conditioning with pharmacokinetically guided administration of busulfan, patients received a single infusion of Ristocel and were followed for a mean of 6.6 months. Treatment with Ristocel was followed by rapid engraftment and durable expression of anti-sickling fetal hemoglobin and reduction in sickle hemoglobin. These data support further investigation of Ristocel to treat sickle cell disease. Cerebral amyloid angiopathy. A review article by Steven Greenberg from Massachusetts General Hospital, Boston. Cerebral amyloid angiopathy is a major cause of hemorrhagic stroke, a frequent contributor to age-related cognitive impairment, and a key component in adverse responses to beta-amyloid immunotherapy. Defined by pathological deposition of beta-amyloid in the small blood vessels of the brain, cerebral amyloid angiopathy is most often diagnosed on the basis of MRI studies showing multiple hemorrhages or leptomeningeal blood products within or overlying the cerebral cortex. The disorder typically manifests as hemorrhagic stroke or as a contributing factor to cognitive decline, and less commonly, with transient focal neurologic symptoms or a cerebral inflammatory autoimmune syndrome. The high risk of recurrent hemorrhagic strokes associated with cerebral amyloid angiopathy poses a particular challenge in patients with indications for antithrombotic therapy and dictates a carefully individualized weighing of risks and benefits. Ongoing research is focused on tools to aid in risk prediction, early diagnostic markers, and identification of key pathogenic steps as targets for disease-modifying therapies. A clinical case of cerebral amyloid angiopathy is shown in our Images in Clinical Medicine this week. An 86-year-old man presented to the neurology clinic with 2 years of progressive memory loss and difficulty walking. An MRI showed more than 500 hypointense round foci throughout the lobar regions, with relative sparing of deep structures, findings consistent with the pattern of cerebral microbleeds seen in cerebral amyloid angiopathy. See the MRI at nejm.org. In another image, a 22-year-old man presented with a 5-day history of painful lesions on his hands, feet, lips, and tongue. Physical examination showed erosions on the tongue and target lesions on the palms. PCR testing was positive for herpes simplex virus, HSV type 1. A diagnosis of erythema multiforme associated with HSV infection was made. Immune Interference, a Clinical Problem Solving, by Masami Matsumura from Jichi Medical University, Shimotsuke, Japan, and co-authors. A 62-year-old man presented with 6 months of fatigue, anorexia, weight loss, a persistent pruritic rash, and diffuse lymphadenopathy. The rash spread from his back to the trunk, extremities, palms, and soles, and did not improve with antibiotics or topical therapy. Examination revealed widespread tender lymph nodes and pustular skin lesions, and laboratory studies showed marked inflammation. Extensive testing for infections, autoimmune disease, and cancer was unrevealing, and initial biopsies were inconclusive. Imaging confirmed diffuse lymphadenopathy, and ultimately, mycobacterial cultures from blood and lymph nodes grew Mycobacterium abscessus, indicating disseminated infection. Further evaluation uncovered neutralizing anti-interferon gamma autoantibodies, revealing an acquired immunodeficiency. The patient initially improved with combination antimicrobial therapy, but his course was complicated by recurrence due to antibiotic resistance and by a paradoxical inflammatory reaction, with new liver lesions despite clinical improvement. With adjustment of therapy, his symptoms resolved and he returned to work. This case highlights an unusual cause of immunodeficiency presenting with disseminated non-tuberculous mycobacterial infection. From mission to margin in academic medicine, the impact of corporate medicine on medical training. A perspective on the corporatization of U.S. healthcare by Jatin Vyas from the Columbia University Vagelos College of Physicians and Surgeons, New York. Academic medical centers offer two interconnected promises of public goods, one for today, advanced patient care and safety net care, and one for tomorrow, research and medical education. But this covenant is under substantial strain. The corporatization of AMC medicine, with profit generation elevated as the primary goal, is directly threatening medical training and the broader mission. When the primary goal is to maximize profit generation, the tendency is to focus only on the care that drives profit, and medical education, medical research, and community service risk being reduced to cost centers. Attempts to boost profits have led to high patient volumes, increased focus on relative value unit, RVU, metrics, and operational efficiencies, where getting the work done is valued over both patient primacy and intellectual curiosity. The shift from viewing our trainees as future colleagues to seeing them as a workforce devalues them. The author calls for reforms, emphasizing that training programs need to put the education back into graduate medical education and rededicate AMCs to the public good, and suggests that hospital leaders should be physicians who engage in direct patient care and work alongside trainees. Both trainees and patients deserve servant leaders who prioritize patient needs over financial gain. Without realignment, the profit motive overshadows the patient primacy for which medicine has long strived. Medicaid's generous, most favored nation pricing model, promise and limitations. A perspective by Luca Maney from Harvard Medical School, Boston, and co-authors. On November 10th, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, CMS, released a request for applications seeking pharmaceutical manufacturer participation in the GENERIS, Generating Cost Reductions for U.S. Medicaid, model, a pilot program intended to reduce Medicaid drug spending and improve drug access. Under the program, participating pharmaceutical manufacturers would offer additional rebates based on how their prices compare with those in other high-income countries, specifically the non-U.S. Group of Seven countries, Canada, France, Germany, Italy, Japan, and the United Kingdom, plus Denmark and Switzerland. In return, the federal government would set standardized rules for how the drugs are covered. State Medicaid programs could then choose whether to adopt those terms. States that participate would give up any extra rebates they had negotiated on their own, but would still keep the standard Medicaid rebates required by law. Medicaid programs are facing growing financial strain as the use of high-cost specialty drugs rises. And there is broad public and bipartisan support for lowering drug prices, especially for low-income patients and those with complex conditions. The GENERIS model brings together two ideas to address this: centralized coverage negotiations and what's known as most favored nation pricing, which links U.S. prices to those in other countries. Although this approach may help reduce costs, tying prices to fixed international benchmarks could limit its impact. And because participation is voluntary, its overall effect remains uncertain. Reforming payment for clinician-administered drugs. Most favored nation pricing in Medicare Part B. A perspective by Thomas Huang from Brigham and Women's Hospital, Boston, and co-authors. Addressing escalating spending on prescription drugs by Medicare Part B, which covers clinician-administered drugs, has been a top U.S. policy priority. On December 19th, the Trump administration announced a new payment model to align Medicare Part B fee-for-service payments for prescription drugs with international pricing benchmarks. This proposal, the Global Benchmark for Efficient Drug Pricing, GLOBE model, was released alongside parallel Most Favored Nation pricing models for Medicare Part D, guarding U.S. Medicare against rising drug costs, or GARD, and Medicaid, generating cost reductions for U.S. Medicaid, or GENERIS. These announcements followed a May 2025 executive order calling for most favored nation pricing and previous efforts by the Obama administration and the first Trump administration to control Part B spending. If implemented, the GLOBE model could reduce costs for Medicare beneficiaries, taxpayers, and the Medicare program. But exceptions could limit participation in the model, and in the absence of safeguards, its provisions could alter incentives for innovation. Read more from our issue at nejm.org. Let us know what you think about our podcast. Any comments or suggestions may be sent to audio@nejm.org. Thank you for listening.